Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm David Crossan, Executive Director of the California Historical Society and your moderator for tonight's program. It is my honor to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Kevin Starr, legendary scholar, honored librarian, popular columnist, respected consultant to generations of public officials, and author of the new book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. I can remember exactly when I first saw the Golden Gate Bridge in person. Remarkably, I was 1,300 miles east of San Francisco Bay at the time, and I saw it on the radio. At 6:45 in the evening, immediately following Irving R. Levine and the news, one of the last evening soaps on the radio, One Man's Family. We've got a lot of old people here. All right. Set in San Francisco, was introduced with the melodious blare of a foghorn, which, come to think of it, sounded a lot like a vuvuzela. As a child sitting at my Iowa dinner table, I literally watched the fog as it blew through the Golden Gate Bridge and thickened and eventually shrouded the magnificent bridge from my view. When I finally moved here 40 years later, I was not surprised in the least that the bridge looked exactly as I had imagined it, only more so, just like California. So no one is more qualified to write on the Golden Gate Bridge or any other California subject than Dr. Kevin Starr. A native of San Francisco, Dr. Starr graduated from the University of San Francisco and received master's and doctoral degrees from Harvard University and a master's of library science degree from the University of California. He has served as San Francisco public librarian and is state librarian of California emeritus. Currently, he is university professor of history at the University of Southern California. His monumental 7-volume and counting, Americans and the California Dream series has earned him the National Medal for the Humanities, the Centennial Medal of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. However, I'm absolutely positive that the honors for which Dr. Starr is most proud are receiving the gold medal of the Commonwealth Club of California and being named a fellow of the California Historical Society. Dr. Starr's most recent book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge, has just been released by Bloomsbury Press. So please join me in welcoming once more to the Commonwealth Club of California, Dr. Kevin Starr.
Thank you, David, and thank you for evoking, for those of us of a certain vintage, that wonderful period of radio, the golden age of radio, which lasted so briefly in terms of its golden age, basically mid-30s to mid-50s, in terms of the programs, and really engendered in anyone raised by radio the ability to visualize, as you visualize, the Golden Gate Bridge 1,000 miles away. And that sense of the power of radio remains. Of course, radio has transmuted itself into other modes now, although I think possibly we might see a recurrence of radio drama at some point in the future. Well, it's a pleasure to be here to talk about this latest book of mine, which is a very brief book. The publisher said they wanted just 40,000 words. And I said, it takes me 40,000 words to clear my throat. All my other books run 400 or 500 pages, etc. But they wanted this very precise. So it's a very interesting exercise in writing a book this kind. And you also depend very much on the marvelous written record to include my fellow St. Ignatius of San Francisco student John Vanderzee's History of the Bridge, which came out during the 50th anniversary. Mine is not a history in the full sense of the word. I don't think it's time for anything like that. John Vanderzee's book is very important. It's more a meditation on the meaning of the bridge, the multiple meanings of the bridge. Now, I start on this premise, a sort of a Zen premise, if you will, that the bridge doesn't need interpretation. It is its own best experience, its own best statement, its own resolution. It is at once a major achievement of high art, and a major achievement of engineering fused, and a great social symbol fused into all those other multiple meetings, and a very practical way of getting us from one side of the bay, the strait to the other. And it's all those things at once. On the other hand, if we survey not just the United States, but survey human history, there are these iconic structures that tempt us to interpret. The Great Wall of China, the Golden Gate Bridge is in that category. The Empire State Building. You can make your own choices. And even something as seemingly ephemeral as the Hollywood sign has over time now gathered unto itself iconic power. The Eastern Russian and Greek Orthodox Church sees the icon as being not only the representation of the sacred, but having in itself a certain power in the very materiality, the very presence of it. And I think that's what we mean when we talk about architectural icons, that they emanate a sense of place, a sense of environment, and they contain a sort of a quality of stored time, stored moral meaning, stored imaginative dimension from the period that created it. And then that stored time and meaning and is continued over time by the successive generations who absorb the bridge and or absorb the icon. And I think that each of you, if you look back and maybe the first time you saw the went to the top of the Empire State Building, or the first time you, say, here locally in San Francisco, went to the top of the Mark, or saw Grace Cathedral atop Knob Hill. There's any number of cable cars. Why do people line up, for instance, to wait to take a cable car ride coming from all over the world to do that? Because of that iconic power. Now, as a fourth-generation San Franciscan, I thought I'd give it a try, having lived in the presence of the bridge. I thought I'd give it a try for to interpret it, to sort of tease out some of its aesthetic and psychological and other social historical dimensions, and at the same time give a narrative designed for somebody being introduced to the bridge, a narrative of how this was achieved. We have to remember now that the Golden Gate Bridge, among other things, was not a federal project. The San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge was a federal project. President Herbert Hoover, in the last phase of his presidency, put aside that Reconstruction finance money for the construction of the Golden Gate of the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge. But the Golden Gate Bridge was done by the counties around San Francisco, and to include Del Norte County on the Oregon border. Because they felt stifled. They felt circumscribed. They felt cut off from their hinterlands. We have to remember that as of 1909, 60% of the population of California, of all the state, was around the San Francisco Bay Area. This is before the rise of Los Angeles. Los Angeles having about 100,000, 120,000 people by 1900. The rise of Southern California coming from the a period when the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, I love to say that. I think like the Judy Garland movie, the Atchison, Topeka, Santa Fe, it's almost a poem in itself as a name, arrives in Southern California, it grows. But up until that time, the population is here in the greater Bay Area. Jack London, for instance, goes up to the northern coastal California in 1910, 1911. He calls it Switzerland, the Switzerland. He's doing this just a few years after Henry James, after 20 years of living abroad, comes back to the United States, goes to Southern California, visiting his relatives here in San Francisco, goes to Southern California and calls it an Italy awaiting its history. Jack London calls the North Coast a Switzerland awaiting its Switzerlandization, if there's such a word. But you can't do that if you're cut off from the hinterlands. Mother Nature has cut you off. Now, we have this extraordinary, marvelous fairy culture, and I try and evoke that very briefly. My good friend, the recently deceased Jerry Flam, wrote a wonderful book on fairies, and I remember my mother taking me on fairies in the 1940s and early 50s, the whole culture that people had in commuting on the ferries. And some 50,000 people a day came into and out of San Francisco during a work week, coming into the ferry building, built in the 1890s. It was the second most busy terminal after Charing Cross Station, London, at the time, in terms of sheer commuter traffic. But it wasn't enough. The Golden Gate Bridge was automotively driven, because with the rise of the automobile, the whole question of relationship to the North in terms of business, tourism, travel, et cetera, the North Coast was automobile dependent. There was a narrow gauge railroad, but it certainly couldn't take the kind of traffic that began to develop even as early as the 1880s and 90s around the Russian River area, then further north into Lake County and into Mendocino County. If you came back at a certain point in the 1920s on a Sunday evening in your automobile, you could spend 3, 4, in certain cases, 5 hours waiting to get your automobile on the ferry. I've been asked a number of times why the Golden Gate Bridge didn't have a second floor or bottom floor for interurban electric like the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. Well, the North Coast, Marin County, which was the driving force for the Golden Gate Bridge to connect with San Francisco City and County, did not have the interurban electric culture that the East Bay had with the Key System, which was a spectacular culture, praised by the great German planner Werner Hagemann when he came and did a plan for Oakland in 1911. And to this day, you can see the sort of surviving tracks there that come all through the East Bay and Piedmont and Oakland Hills, et cetera. It really was a remarkable system, and it does not have a counterpart in the East Bay. So there's practical necessity. There's politics. I mean, Doyle Drive is named after Frank Doyle, who is a banker, head of Santa Rosa Chamber of Commerce, a business person who facilitates the political organization of the bridge. And there are earlier calls for the bridge, very dramatically, by Emperor Norton. Now, to this day, I really can't figure out whether Emperor Norton was having us all on, whether he was allegedly had a nervous breakdown after he tried to corner the rice market in San Francisco, and then that failed, and he's supposed to have a nervous breakdown and dress himself up in a uniform as the Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. But he lived free. All his hotel bills were paid. His restaurants were picked up at Jack's and Tadish Grill and all these wonderful places that now cost a fortune to go to. But so maybe the Emperor knew something that the rest of us didn't about the need for a city to have public theater and public theatrical personalities. But he called for the bridge. Called for the bridge to Marin. But I think he suggested a little something about himself when he wanted it to go out to the Fairlawns, so leave Marin County. Incidentally, as late as the 1950s, there was a call for another bridge going from the Marin County to Alcatraz into San Francisco. And I always think of it as maybe going from Tiburon to the top of the Mark and back. It would have been very much a kind of typical of that period, a Marin County expedition. But all this aside, the pressure is building in the early and the proposals are building. In many cases, Marin County driven in the early 1900s. Two very charismatic figures, three actually, if you include A.P. Giannini, come to the fore. Joseph Strauss, who is an impresario of bridges, not necessarily a great bridge designer, but a great executive producer of bridges. And that itself is an essential role. And O'Shaughnessy, Michael O'Shaughnessy, our great civic city engineer, who Mayor Rolfe had a meeting with him at the Whitcomb Hotel in the aftermath of the earthquake and fire, and said, I've got a job for you. He was at San Diego at the time, having worked earlier in San Francisco, the rebuilding of a great city. I mean, what a challenge if you're a civil engineer, not just to build a building or a district or a highway, but an entire city. And O'Shaughnessy and Strauss in the early 20s issue a pamphlet, which I had the privilege of examining at the as California State Library when I was a librarian, which helped me sort of get the idea of doing this book, and made the proposal of this bridge as a memorial to the lost, the American lost, of World War I. Now, the bridge was two cantilevered structures joined by a small suspension structure. A critic called it said it looked like an inverted rat trap. And if that had been said about something I designed, I would have I would just go slink home. But Strauss did not. He eventually assembled a team. He assembled the best bridge designers literally in the world. They brought them together. And they are a representative group, Leon Mosiev from Latvia, and O.H. Ammann from Switzerland, and Charles Alton Ellis, a Yankee, the 8th, 10th generation Yankee from Maine, and Charles Derluth, professor of civil engineering at Berkeley, brings all this group together. Irving Morrow, the architect from Oakland, whose wife Dorothy Morrow was busy here in San Francisco laying out St. Francis Wood and other projects. And so this incredible work of art and this work of engineering is done by a team. And I think that's a remarkable thing. And I talk about that, the cooperation among them all. Mosiev taking those towers and lightening them, tapering them, bringing them lighter and lighter up and higher. You have a sense that the perfect bridge for Mosiev would have been just an invisible bridge if it disappeared altogether. Only that would be light enough for him to bear the weight of traffic. And what they pulled together cumulatively was, in my opinion, high art, high engineering, a high response to social purpose, a galvanic response to the Great Depression in terms of creating a work for the American worker, and even more subtly, a suggestion that the American worker was alive and well, that we were not, even though we were in the midst of a Great Depression, we were not down and out for the entire count. Now, I organized this book very simply because I want to move in almost intuitive ways from place to place. I talk about the bridge as icon. I talk about the site itself, the storing of time and history in the site, the geological time, and the sense of vision, the vision of John Charles Fremont, the explorer, the Army explorer who first named the Golden Gate Bridge in honor of the Golden Horn of Constantinople, Istanbul, Constantinople, in the mid-1840s. Chrysopole, Golden Horn. My wife and I were in Istanbul recently and had the privilege of seeing that it's kind of chauvinist to say San Franciscan since the city was a couple thousand years older than San Francisco, but to see that, or let's just say to come back to San Francisco and see the Istanbulian aspects of San Francisco and that great city rising up on the bay, and also the sense of stored time, geological time, the time of the formation of the bay itself, and I go into that as briefly as possible, the formation of the bay and the disappearance of the bay at regular intervals in the past. And politics. Now, thank God for politics, quite frankly. Now, I am a bureaucrat altogether in my career. If you take my army time as an assistant adjutant, 5 years as city librarian and 10 years as state librarian, bureaucrat is not a bad 17 years. Bureaucrat is not a bad word for me. Good bureaucracy, good public administration depends on good politics. It's for the politicians to hammer out what the people want. And once that's hammered out, then they turn it over to the civil servants and the professionals, et cetera, and they say, landscape it, build it, make it happen. And that the politics went on for 10 years. There were deep divisions. The Sierra Club, I hope I'm not insulting anybody from the Sierra Club. Sierra Club didn't want the bridge there. I thought it would be a profanation of nature. I agree with John Van Der Zee saying that like the Parthenon atop that hill in Athens, the Golden Gate Bridge actually enhances nature, intensifies the natural statement of nature there, and makes a statement really about California itself, the joining of the dense urban structure of San Francisco rising like Atlantis from the sea, the bridge, and then the wild, forever preserved headlands of Marin. It makes a wonderful statement about who we are as Californians. After all, George Santayana, great philosopher, addressing the Berkeley Philosophical Union in 1910, made the point. He said, I'm paraphrasing him now, he said, you Californians take nature as your primary symbol, yet you're the most developed and engineered part of the country. And that's a fact. In fact, if you look at Census 2000, and I'm sure this will be borne out by Census 2010, Census 2000 shows California to be the most urbanized, suburbanized of all the states. The least is Vermont. So somewhere between the extremes of Vermont and California, this sense of nature, this sense of and human civility, the Golden Gate Bridge achieves this extraordinary power. And then money. The San Francisco-based bank, AP Giannini. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when Joseph Strauss came in and wanted the loan, first construction loan, a line of credit that would move over $30 million to build the bridge, guaranteed by the voters. But the voters only guaranteed it. The voters didn't put the money up. They just said they would guarantee it. The bonds had to be redeemed by revenues. And Giannini gave that money and financed that bridge the same way that that he was financing Hollywood, that he was financing so many wonderful things, and how in the aftermath of World War II he would finance the Kaiser Permanente health program. And then the design, I went into the design itself, and in this case I doubled back into Greek philosophy and proto-philosophy with Pythagoras and Plato, and I'm justifying doing that because Charles Alton Ellis read the original Greek every night. He was inspired by Greek civilization, Greek culture, and had that literacy in the classics, which was characteristic of so many Americans in an earlier period. And that idea that if we work with mathematics and do engineering analysis, et cetera, we're not just using an arbitrary symbol system. We are making an effort to employ the very language of creation itself, or the material universe itself, or the cosmos itself. If you think of Charles Alton Ellis sitting at his desk with just a paper and pencil, a tab, working out the calculations as to whether this bridge would work. No computers, no machinery, just his theories. In 1937, they published some of his arithmetic. To me, it has a kind of almost hieroglyphic quality of sacred script to see him probing as to whether or not this thing could be done, that we could take and reorder atoms, molecules, stresses, weights, and achieve what Mosiev said could be done, but which Alton Ellis had to prove. And then the construction by American workers at a time when so many of them were unemployed. Small things, too, like the innovation of the hard hat that Joseph Strauss, who was very safety conscious, demanded that everybody wear hard hats. Or the fact that if you showed up on Monday morning and you looked slightly hungover, you had to drink a quart of sauerkraut juice before they let you climb the tower. Or the enlightened policies, for instance, of the Rebling Company, which spun the cables, which also spun the cables for the Brooklyn Bridge. I'll come back to the Brooklyn Bridge in a moment. The enlightened policies of the Rebling saying if you've done your job and you're up at 400, 500, 600 feet and you finish your job, don't make work. Don't worry about it. Stop. Have a cigarette. Wait for the next task. I hope to say this is 1930s, so don't be after me because I say have a cigarette. This is another era as far as smoking is concerned. And wait for the next task to come. Don't do busy work. Busy work just multiplies capacities for error and for accidents. The estimation at the time was that if you built a bridge like on this scale, for every $1 million you spent, you'd have to lose one life. That meant that we were scheduled to lose 37 lives for the Golden Gate Bridge. By the time the project was reaching its completion, only one life had been lost. I'm not saying that that's not a tragedy. That one life was a tragedy as well. A young man killed by a flying beam that hit him as he was working. But in that last sequence, pulling aside the stripping that had been set, the framework that had been set for the laying of the road bed, some bolts broke, and the platform collapsed into the tower, into the net that Strauss had put there because he was so safety-oriented, and another 10 were lost. But it's an epic of American work. It's photographed beautifully at this time. And I mentioned the Brooklyn Bridge because when we come to the question of the artistic response to the Golden Gate Bridge, we obviously think of the Brooklyn Bridge. The Brooklyn Bridge, I think just even recently, the David McCulloch book and the PBS series and all sorts of responses to that. The great poem by Hart Crane, The Bridge, 1930. The wonderful three-panel paintings by Joseph Stella done around the time of World War I. There's an extraordinary sense of outpouring of affection for the Brooklyn Bridge on the part of the New York aesthetic and intellectual world in the early 1900s, to suggest their hopes that the industrial culture of America would be benevolent, would not necessarily be something destructive, and it would not be Fritz Lang's metropolis, but would be something else, like the bridge itself, modified, the Brooklyn Bridge, with its Gothic revival towers, the way the Golden Gate Bridge is modified by its gorgeous Art Deco towers, as enhanced and perfected by Irving Morrow, building upon John Boardman's theatrical designs, building upon suggestions made by San Francisco artist Maynard Dixon, who played such an important role in getting international orange as the color. And I think in terms of my chapter on the city, I make a slight original contribution here, but it's actually building upon Mr. McDonald's suggestion, the architect for the for the enhancement and development of the bridge, that it was linked to the City Beautiful movement. We start thinking of the Golden Gate Bridge from 1937 to the present. You see time that way. Turn around and see San Francisco destroyed by earthquake and fire in April 1906. See the rebuilding of the city. See the City Beautiful plan that was done by Daniel Hudson Burnham for San Francisco in 1905. You then put the Golden Gate Bridge in another perspective, as coming out of that energy that I signify with Arthur and Lucia Matthews, the Persopolis group, and I suggest the paintings in Sacramento suggesting the kind of city and the kind of motivation that led to the Panama Pacific International Exposition and then to the Golden Gate Bridge. So in one sense, the Golden Gate Bridge looks forward. In one sense, it epitomizes the Art Deco, the 1930s. In another sense, its energies come out of a 20-year sequence of rebuilding the city. And the question of the color of international orange. If you look at the coloration of the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 15, if you look at the Panama California Exposition in San Diego in 15, you can see this hunger for colors that express California, that move in dialogue with the atmospherics of California. And the color sequences of the Panama Pacific, I think, lead towards the decision to do the bridge in international orange. The War Department wants black, the Army Air Corps wants another stripe color, the Navy wants another color. But the primer was international orange, and people like Benny Bufano here in San Francisco, the artist, Maynard Dixon, the painter, say, let's keep the international orange, let's just change that primer into lead paint and make that the color. And today, to this day, that's part of that collaborative effort. It's perfect. There is no other color as perfect as that for that bridge. There is no other color that enhances the atmospherics in sight. There is no other color that suggests something deep and powerful about California. Well, the minute I say that, I have to remind myself what Fred Allen said. He said, California is a wonderful place, he said, if you're an orange. So we have to take a little satire, too, when we exalt that orange color. And then I deal with the suicides. This morning I was on PBS talking about my book, and someone called in And they had just been on the bridge the other day, and they were walking across the bridge, and they saw a young woman stand up on the fence there and throw herself off. Stand there for a while. People entreated her to come back, and she threw herself off. Well, now, if this had been 40 years ago, that would have been reported in the paper, and it might have been people would keep tallies, et cetera. It was not treated as serious. We've absorbed over time now that we've had 1,200 to 1,300, possibly even 1,400 suicides because some people might have gone off in the wee hours of the morning or in the dark of night and been swept out to sea. We've absorbed a tragic sense of suicide. That is a branch of that's a part of mental disease. It could be genetically related, and that we have very little evidence of people who survive. But the two or three people that we've talked to who survived said they changed their mind the first second they were off. But of course, they only had three more seconds. It's a 4-second drop, and it's a certain end, or the end comes very certainly after the fall. And I think there's part of the sensitivity of our culture to mental illness, to emotional stress, et cetera, et cetera. And again, this has been very significantly Marin County driven, that we're moving towards some kind of suicide prevention program that would prevent this young lady the other day who ended her life. And I deal with that. I deal with the power of the bridge, the beauty, the quality of that behind beauty is something else as well, and looking at that from a point of view. And then I go in the last chapter is on art, and I deal with this question of why hasn't the Golden Gate Bridge a lot of art? Although I mention all the movies, I mention the novel Golden Gate, which is written in sonnet form. I mentioned the use of the Golden Gate Bridge in ads. Incidentally, it's in the public domain, so you could have a great ad and not have to pay anything for the setting. And the lack of interpretation of it or artistic, I think, is part of the power of the bridge. The bridge doesn't require artistic interpretation. It is itself a powerful, transcendent work of art. And on the other hand, just like the Brooklyn Bridge, I think in time a body of interpretation will grow up around the bridge. It'll start to mean things more and more as time goes on. And I use the word time advisedly because I deal with the whole question of time, the mystery of time, the fact that the bridge has to be constantly maintained, the fact that the bridge is in dialogue with the eons of time in its setting and is itself, if not maintained, can be a victim of time. And I try and conclude the book on that level. And let me just share a little bit of the last part with you. Still, for the time being, and that time being could last for centuries, the Golden Gate Bridge remains a world icon. What does the bridge mean finally after each of its engineering and architectural achievements is explored? As in the case of all great art, there remains an element of mystery. Like a Bach fugue or Beethoven's Ninth or a symphony by Mahler, the Golden Gate Bridge can be analyzed in terms of its parts and functions. In its final effect and meaning, however, the bridge is more than the sum total of any of these. The Golden Gate Bridge embodies a beauty at once useful and transcendent. It emanates the music of mathematics and design and offers enduring proof that human beings can alter the planet with reverence, even mend or complete their environment for social purposes. The bridge is a triumphant structure, a testimony to the creativity of mankind. At the same time, it also asserts the limits and brevity of human achievement in a cosmos that is as endless and ancient as time itself. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Starr. For those of you who are listening to us, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus, who is discussing his newest book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. It's now time for audience question period, and I want to begin with one that you, Dr. Starr, as erudite, as well-read, as eloquent as you are, cannot answer. Am I the only person here who walked over the bridge on the first day it opened? All right, how many, well, you didn't ask the question, I take it. How many people here walked the bridge the first day it opened? Would you raise your hands, please? One, two people.
Each of you must have been pushed across in a perambulator.
One of the questions that probably follows automatically on this, Dr. Starr, is explain what happened on the 50th anniversary walk, and how close did the bridge come to collapsing that day?
Well, I have a whole half chapter on that in the book.
Right.
And we're not used to, just as a culture, handling spontaneous pedestrian crowds of 250,000 people. That's an unexpected phenomenon in our culture. We can handle a Giants game or a 49ers game, etc., but 250,000 people materializing between 5:30 and 6:30, 7:30 is pretty unexpected. And the volunteers who set up the committee, and even the Highway Patrol and the Sheriff's Office from Marin County in San Francisco, weren't expected for that kind of absolute impacting rush across the bridge, breaking down the barriers, going an hour ahead of time, and those 250,000 people standing on that bridge. Now, fortunately, as I go into the discussion here, the bridge had been fixed and reinforced earlier, a number of months earlier, to take a larger load. It did bend. I'm not an engineer, so I can't speculate what might have happened, but certainly it's to think, even to think about it, is to think of, imagine the unimaginable. And I think that when we have our 75th anniversary of the bridge, we should understand, I think we will have been much wiser about crowd control, much wiser on controlling and not letting something like that happen. Now, on the other hand, as I bring out in my book, people behave well. People behave well. A couple of drunks on the periphery, but people behave well. There's no example of egregious misbehavior in that kind of situation, which also began to get more when the wind began to blow and the bridge began to sway back and forth, etc. There could have been a panic, but we Americans that morning behaved well in a totally unexpected, unprepared for crisis, which paradoxically was out of love of the bridge.
Thank you. We have our questions have sort of grouped. Several are on the more general and somewhat philosophical side, and many of them, I can tell you, having read the book, can be answered specifically in the book, so we're going to encourage you to buy the book and support Dr. Starr's lifestyle.
I'm a USC professor. I don't need the money.
So I want to start with how would you describe the bridge to someone who had perhaps not only not seen it, but not even seen anything like it? How would you describe it to someone from somewhere in the world where such an edifice is even?
If they had a background in mathematics, which I don't, but I would look at mathematical formulas and say, what are we looking at here? What is all this arithmetic discuss? What's the tool for this arithmetic? What's it mean? And can it be used to apply to the material world, to the arrangements that can be done to the material world? And therefore, can we take number with a capital M and materialize it, in this case, for a bridge? So you could do that from an engineering point of view. Now, if you were talking to somebody from an artistic background, you might make reference to Richard Serra, our native San Francisco painter, who just got the National Medal of the Arts from President Obama, whose great heroic steel structures are at the Bilbao and the Frank Gehry building, beautifully heroic structures. And I would say, well, let's just think of a work of art, a sculpture, and approach the bridge from that direction. And if the person were a city planner type or a politician, you could suggest the urban politics that went into it and ultimately ask them to fuse all those things together. You talk about the Depression and the symbolic value of a project like this at a time of national crisis. And then in the long run, say, forget everything I said. Just here's a picture. Take a look at it. Let it speak for itself.
This question, maybe we can have a point counterpoint with David McCullough on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yes.
Would the bridge have achieved such fame if it were not for the large number of military passing through San Francisco before and after the war? And if it were the standard battleship Gray, would the Golden Gate not be second in beauty to the Brooklyn Bridge?
Well, if it were, I'll take your second part first. The battleship Gray, I think International Orange is part of the total solution. It's part of the achievement. It's not just decoration. It's part of the statement. It's part of the, if I can dust off this word, it's part of the ontology of the bridge. In terms of the military, of course, it's like saying, is the Statue of Liberty the Statue of Liberty because it's the Statue of Liberty or because of all those generations of immigrants who came in, saw it, and whose cumulative moral and personal experience becomes part of the fabric of our American culture. If you think of the 1.2, I think, million young men and women shipped out during World War II from Fort Mason going under that bridge and then later Korea, and looking at that bridge and thinking that they're going into harm's way and then coming back and seeing it, that they will have the life that they dreamt of having, that somehow accumulates to the bridge. You can't. It accumulates to the bridge in a manner similar or parallel to the suicides. It's part of the social iconography of this bridge as a social icon. So I think that World War II veterans, Korean veterans, et cetera, when in Vietnam we tended to fly our troops out from Oakland Airport on World Airways, but maybe they saw that bridge as they moved over to Vietnam. So it has that quality of hope for return, hope for safety.
This question, addresses your earlier comment on political leadership. Do you think that monumental public work projects like the Golden Gate Bridge are still feasible today?
Yes, on one condition, that we restore politics. That we restore old-fashioned politics. There were deep divisions about this bridge. The Sierra Club, which did so many wonderful things and continues to do so many wonderful things, had a point of view on this. The War Department had a point of view on this. Some of the counties to the north had tax issues, in Mendocino County, et cetera, on the problem. San Francisco had problems with this because it wanted a larger representation given its larger population. But politically, they got together. The politicians worked this out. The elected officials in Sacramento and the county supervisors, they worked it out. They didn't demonize each other. They didn't bring the whole system to a halt. Now, they took a good over time towards a half decade to work it out. But they were practicing politics as Aristotle and Bismarck both agree is the art of the possible. You sit down in a smoky room. I hope it's a smoky room with good old boys and good old girls. And you sit there and you say, what do you want? What do I want? And can you take this if I give you that? And if I give you that, will you give me that? And that's the impact. I think today people ask me about California because I've spent 40-umpting years writing California history. Well, what about California today? What's the problem? The problem is a breakdown in politics. The liberals, conservatives, left, right, they're not dealing with each other. Right now in Sacramento, they're all standing off on the budget. In 50 years ago, they'd all get together. They'd go over to Frank Fats and they'd eat Chinese food. Then they'd go down the Torch Club, have a little maker's mark, and then they'd pass a budget. But
I like the maker's mark part. Maybe that's what we
remember. Was it William Butler Yeats said that an intellectual hatred is the worst? And when politics becomes impossible, when we demonize the other side, I'm not talking, listen, I am an old-fashioned Democrat appointed state librarian by a Republican, Pete Wilson, reappointed by a Democrat, Gray Davis, and reappointed by a Republican, Arnold Schwarzenegger. So my politics are very flexible, let me tell you. I like the center, and I admire politics. I think it's important to have conservatives, important to have liberals, important to have the center, but it's important that people finally move, our elected officials move the case along. That's what we pay them for. So that's a long-winded answer to say that ultimately the political sector did not fail this bridge. It had some arguments with it, had enlightened self-interest, had some horse trading to do. There's nothing wrong with that. There was nothing criminal in that give and take of political discourse. And did I answer your question? No, I kind of evaded it. I avoided it. Yes, we could do it today, but we have to reestablish our political culture in California that says to everybody, in the long run, let's move ahead. Give and take, and let's not keep drawing lines in the sand that paralyze the body politic. That's a mixed metaphor. Lines cannot paralyze, but you know what I'm trying to suggest.
Do you see a time when the bridge will become obsolete?
No. I don't see a time that Beethoven's Ninth is going to be obsolete. Remember, if you saw the Star Wars movies... Captain Kirk, not the TV, but the motion pictures. Starfleet's headquartered in San Francisco, and the one where they bring the whale down, et cetera. They show the Golden Gate Bridge, although it has another level to it. I think Bart finally gets across on Golden Gate Bridge by the 2500s. No, I think if we take care of it, it'll last because we're replacing it all the time. Look what we're doing now with the marvelous work with Doyle Drive and the reconstruction there. We replaced the rivets and we've done. So the thing, it has a kind of life to it. It's an analogy to life, and because the maintenance is constant. And I think just as you see anything that's well maintained, that over time, I don't see the bridge because of its artistic power. You're asking a question that if the Golden Gate Bridge were ultimately discarded, it'd be like apocalyptic, it'd be like the end of the Planet of the Apes when Charlton Heston comes and sees the Statue of Liberty as just a broken head in the sand, meaning that the great republic of USA has finished. So I think it's there for a long time, provided we're there for a long time, and provided that we sustain the level of culture and sophisticated politics and commitment that gave rise to the bridge in the first place.
I'm trying to think of how many Roman structures are still bringing water down to cities.
Listen, so. David, if you go to the monastery of John and Paul in Rome, which is right by the Forum, the gardens there are watered by an aqueduct that's over 2,000 years old, still working.
What color is it?
I don't know. Well, it's Traventine.
Oh,
it's
okay. Rome. All right. What... You alluded to this continually replacing the bridge, and here's a follow-up question. What can you tell us about what it takes to maintain the bridge? And then it says, what don't we know? Do we want to know it, I guess? Well,
I'm not an engineer, but I could just say that basically the bridge, if I remember my high school physics about entropy, et cetera, is falling apart. Just like we're falling apart. You may not feel it at any one particular time. Everything is falling apart, and everything has to be reconstituted all the time. And so the bridge left to itself. In fact, there's a lot of interest. There's both a movie and a film about as human beings disappeared, how long it would take Manhattan to go wild again for there to be, et cetera. And over a period of time, there is a calculation as to what would happen. So and from that point of view, the Golden Gate Bridge is a sort of icon of human civilization itself, that it demands care, nurture, maintenance, repair, upgrading, and over time. That's the mystery of time in the bridge. These great engineering projects are defiances of time, but all you have to do is go to Boudrin in Turkey, on the Aegean, that was used to be the city of Halicarnassus, and you see the mausoleum there as a pile of stones. Archaeologists are looking and getting parts, I think, of the Colossus. They think they're finding parts of the great Colossus at Rhodes. It once bestowed Rhodes. The Library of Alexander is gone, although we do have the California State Library in Sacramento, thank God. the Great Wall of China, what a comforting thing the survival of that is. The Hadrian's Wall, the aqueducts you mentioned. We're a relatively new species, although people like Donald Johansson and some of the anthropologists are pushing us back a little further, et cetera. But even when they push us back, we're a relatively new species, and the kind of civilization we've built up over time, especially modern engineering civilization, is at the most 5,000 years old. So we're just getting going. Like Karen Carpenter and Dave is saying, we've only just begun. So the Golden Gate Bridge is there as a promise for a long future of sustainability if we're sustaining our civilization.
You heard it here first, an historian quoting Karen Carpenter. Okay. would you address the preservation of Fort Point at the time? How controversial was it? And I know from reading the book, it was an important
part absolutely. Of the design. If you took a strictly utilitarian point of view, you'd have torn Fort Point down. But Strauss said no. Strauss maintained Fort Point. So you have then the arch over Fort Point is sort of a bridge within a bridge. It's a spectacular arch. And then leads to the second great support system of the San Francisco Pier, which is out in into the water. So Strauss and others maintain that. In a very early act of preservation, preservationism wasn't that powerful in the early 30s as a movement. Getting people working, employed, was powerful. But the soaring over Fort Point and the preservation of that was a great accomplishment of the bridge. And so consequently, you have this marvelous, triumphant composition of the city, the great trees of the Presidio, the eucalyptus trees, and then San Francisco back behind that, rising like Atlantis from the ocean. Then moving across the bridge to the wild headlands of Marin, across this 1860s structure, the whole thing is a marvelous composition. If you were Cecil B. DeMille, you couldn't have designed that set in a better way to suggest to each of us in our lives that we're not just creatures of our time. We're creatures of time past, time present, and time future. And our built environment, our engineered environment, expresses that to us.
This question I know you address in the political segment, but if you address it again here, you describe lobbying for the bridge as early as 1909. Construction was begun much later. It was completed in 39. The question is, why so long?
What took so long?
Yeah, why from the first time the lobbying started as early as 1909, why so long to get the bridge under construction and complete?
That's a wonderful question. I think, again, you can't have Falstaff and have him lean politics. It took time to come up with the resolution. The first systematic thinking about the bridge is the early 20s. The bridge district is formed to mid to late 20s. The bridge political organization, legal challenges are the late 20s, early 30s. So in the long run, if we look at projects today like the new addition to the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge was built with lightning speed. And after, what's 10 years here and there? And I don't know what the texture of time for the 1920s. When you consider that they were moving into unknown territory, they were creating a type of district that had not been created before, an independent bridge district. They were sponsoring the advancement of the state of art of bridge building by quantum leaps. They were dealing with questions that would take time as to whether the geological substructure on the floor of the strait could sustain the weight of the San Francisco Pier. All that, we wouldn't want them to have rushed it any faster. And even when one says that, it just takes time to do this kind of construction.
I would like to remind those who are listening to us tonight that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus, who's discussing his newest book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. The next question, and I know the answer here, but the people here do not. Have you seen Ansel Adams' photo, The Golden Gate Before the Bridge, and what does that stir in you when you see the bridge?
Well, it's a wonderful photograph. And Ansel Adams, of course, grew up there in Seacliff, looking at the strait without the bridge. He photographs it. He was a very active member of the Sierra Club, and he had the Sierra Club's point of view that the bridge was a mistake. We have to respect that. And he photographed it. And he photographs the strait as it was seen by the Spanish when they first sailed in, and it was seen as seen by Fremont when he named it. He photographed the strait as when Josiah Royce, our great California-born philosopher, did his meditation on the gate, for which they using the Golden Gate as a symbol of all that Americans were trying to do to build up a just and good society. I think it's a work of a great work of art. So Ansel Adams, it has a kind of elegiac quality. This is the end of one era, and he knew, and here's the beauty. It's the same way that on a much more dramatic level, I think, that Hetch Hetchy was photographed before the dam went up and took away that little Yosemite. It was a sort of last farewell at the losses and gains, in this case the losses, in effect, that civilization was demanding. But, and I should have asked Ansel Adams this, because I had the privilege of having lunch with him at Jack's. Now, how's that for antiquarianism? But I should have asked that, whether he's changed his mind over time once the bridge was put up and once it looked so beautiful. Once it was so. John Van Der Zee says that only the Parthenon is more ideally suited to its site, or second only to the Parthenon is the Golden Gate Bridge.
You just mentioned Hetch Hetchy. One of the things you didn't mention in your comments tonight is O'Shaughnessy's role. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, O'Shaughnessy was one of the two people who issued the pamphlet in 21-22 calling for the bridge. O'Shaughnessy and had extensive love of Marin County. He used to go over Marin County on the weekends, etc. But by the time the bridge was moving towards construction and entering the last phases of its politics, O'Shaughnessy had very serious cost overruns in Hetch Hetchy. So he sort of disappeared from the support team. In fact, he's at one point said, well, maybe we could postpone it for a while. Now, I'm not demonizing him for that. He had very serious cost overrun problems with the Hetch Hetchy. But what were we doing at that time? We were building the Hetch Hetchy. We were building that incredible aqueduct from the Hetch Hetchy. We were building the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge and moving towards that and towards the Bay Bridge, et cetera. It was a period of heroic construction from a society infinite, 10 times smaller than what we are today.
This is a question I'm not sure I'm going to be able to read correctly. What can you tell us about the plaque? Is this Hooper's hand? And the plaque with dog paws beneath the bridge, favorite joggers and runner spot. Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. Okay. There's a plaque that we reproduce here that gives credit to Strauss, and maybe someday we'll have a plaque that has the whole design team up there.
Regarding... This is a question of, this may be beyond your immediate purview. What's the significance of the different pitches and tunes of the Golden Gate Bridge foghorns? Is that something you can comment on or not?
No, but I wish I could.
Okay.
Because it's sort of a natural music, isn't it? You mentioned listening to One Man's Family and the foghorns out there. And, in fact, when they wanted to replace the foghorns a number of years ago, with an up-to-date sort of radar system, et cetera, there was such a protest from the voters. I think it was during the Alioto administration that brought the foghorns back. And those foghorns that blare out in the film noir set in San Francisco and the Maltese Falcon and Dark Passage, and oh, we don't want to give those up. There's kind of the music of the city, those foghorns at night and the early morning. It's a wonderful poem about San Francisco fog, suggesting the foghorns. I can't tell the pitches, but I do think that cities have sounds. Cities have music. In our case in San Francisco, we can get signature, the clang clang of the cable car, the foghorn. Each city has a kind of ambient sound, a kind of that we live with day by day.
We really are getting into specific questions here, and again.
I wish I were an engineer; I could answer.
Which are right? How can one? Do you know how one can get to ride the Golden Gate Bridge elevator to the top? Is it open to the public? You know,
to make a request to the bridge district, and if you have a purpose for this, they entertain that. You have to sign all kinds of forms. I didn't do it. You have to sign all kinds of forms, et cetera.
A purpose. Do we? Okay. I don't think I'll ask. All right.
Photography.
Yeah. Okay. Do people still covertly climb to the top of the bridge? Do you know? Towers?
Fraternity students with a little skinful of adult beverages, et cetera? Well, there's such an enormous folklore that attaches to the bridge. Tremendous folklore about people's relationship to the toll takers, to the painters who painted a seagull, international orange, which of course today would be considered probably a misdemeanor, a cruelty to animals. I'm not saying these things are true, but there's story after story about the bridge, and of course the story of University of California students scampering up the cables. I just have to suspend judgment. It is possible. After all, a student climbed the Campanile. A couple students climbed the Campanile, so that possibly. But I think they're. I'll tell you one thing that was documented when Strauss put the great net up. He had workers, especially younger workers, in a spirit of bravado, diving into the net. So they had to say, Russ Cohn, the manager of the project, said to say that any worker who dove into the net just to show off would get fired. Young people being what they are, and daredevils, et cetera, who knows?
Well, I think we are at the point of having time for one last question, and so we're going to go totally philosophical here on this one. I think it's absolutely appropriate to end with, especially given your trade. Regarding nonfiction, is there a continued future for physical books, or should all such knowledge be accessible on google.com? Now, we only have 3 minutes.
Well, my guide in this is the late, great Mae West. Mae West is one of my guides. Mae West said, too much of a good thing is wonderful. Mae West also said, when I'm caught between two evils, I always try and choose the evil I've never experienced before. But anyway, too much of a good thing is wonderful. We in the library world watched with initial panic and then bemusement as they predicted the end of the book.
Right.
At that point, we were publishing about 65,000 new titles a year. We're now doing about 150,000, 160,000 titles a year. The book is more prestigious than ever as an object in terms of publication, the book market, et cetera. On the other hand, we've done a tremendous job saving trees, putting raw data that has to be updated and changed and et cetera on the net rather than publishing it, et cetera. There's nothing more, when I was librarian in San Francisco, there's nothing more poignant, I felt, that we had to throw out the guidebooks for 1 year. Say the guidebook to Hong Kong, beautifully produced, all the statistics, but then the guidebook for 1975 would come in and you threw that out, et cetera. So that we're moving an enormous amount of information through digital. Hooray for that. And now we have these wonderful ebook products where you can go on vacation or go around and have 22,000 titles, etc. But there's a certain ceremonial quality to the book, and so the book will be alongside other forms. I had the pleasure as state librarian to administer a $500 million construction fund, $500 million, and thus far with great success. None of the projects have gone south. And that was the voters. Now, you voters wouldn't give us that now because the state's in a different mood. This is when you gave $350 million, leveraging $150. And the pride that cities had in developing new libraries, and the library as community center, and the library as a digital center. I remember when I was state librarian, I used to give a speech saying, we can't let Bill Gates try and get all his computers into our libraries. I used to give that speech, maybe sound kind of reformist. Then I got a call, I went up to the Gates Foundation, and they gave me money to put three computers into every library in the state that had below the poverty line in the 2000 census. And people said, gee, Kevin, you used to give this speech, I don't hear you anymore. What changed your mind? I said, $22 million, it changed my mind. Because we were able to put computers into all these embattled inner city places, rural places, et cetera, alongside books. So remember, too much of a good thing is wonderful. We want our libraries to be computer sophisticated. We want to be able to enforce a certain kind of scholarly discipline, as you can see that happening in Wikipedia. On the other hand, there's a constant temptation for the internet to become a vast galactic junkyard. A lot of it on there is just unregulated. A lot of it's mean-spirited, et cetera. And I think the book will survive alongside these other forms, and the library as an institution is already transmogrified and has a wonderful future as we see new libraries built in Seattle and Chicago and San Francisco and other places throughout the country.
I am personally more prone to quote the NRA or paraphrase it and say they're going to have to pull the book from my dead frozen hands. Our thanks to Dr. Kevin Starr, professor of history at the University of Southern California and author of the new book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. I'm David Crossan, executive director of the California Historical Society and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, now stands adjourned.